let KBOO send you to beautiful Mexico and stay at Casa Tranquila. Or go see a play at Pullman Center Stage with your friends. KBOO's Fall Sweepstakes is currently happening, and these are two of the fabulous prizes that we have in store. For every $15,000 we raise between now and September 9th, we will take one day off our fall membership drive. Other prizes include $500 to Grand Central Bakery, and three different prize packs from Evolution Healthcare and Fitness, including altitude training, massage, and acupuncture. Thank you to all the local businesses that have donated prizes for the KBOO Fall Sweepstakes. A donation is not required to be entered. For rules and more info, kboo.fm/2015fallsweeps.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Elephant Revival is a five-piece band from Colorado that play folk music with Gypsy, Celtic, and Americana influences. The show is originally scheduled for Revolution Hall, and all tickets for that show will be honored. Again, that's Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th, 10:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Let the fires burn tonight. Let the jugs of wine get drunk.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, the nation's only remaining community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. On our program today, Bill Resnick interviews Ann Kornhauser about her recently published book entitled Debating the American State, Liberal Anxieties and the New Leviathan, 1930 to 1970. Kornhauser teaches at the City College of New York. The book discusses the anxiety of liberals who, even as they were building the New Deal state, had concerns about big government. Is there a way that individual choice could bring down capitalism? Today I'll be sharing an article by Colin Todhunter, which argues that we must collectively refuse the capitalist mandate of buy, 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 consume, consume, consume. The article is entitled Refusing Capitalism. Jan Hocken and Todd Sloan will close out today's program with another segment of their Psychology and Politics series. In 2004, psychologist Barry Schwartz published a book titled The Paradox of Choice, arguing that the American obsession with having more choices creates large-scale anxiety, depression, and general unhappiness. Schwartz's analysis generated considerable interest online, including the TED Talk presentation, where Schwartz lays out his basic arguments. Psychologist Jan Hocken and Todd Sloan play a segment from the TED Talk and offer their own critical commentary, including different ways we might think about choice from a progressive perspective. But now here's Bill Resnick talking with Ann Kornhauser about her book, Debating the American State, Liberal Anxieties and the New Leviathan, 1930 to 1970.
Ann Kornhauser, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Ann Kornhauser teaches at the City College of New York. She's a historian. Recently published a book, Debating the American State, Liberal Anxieties and the New Leviathan, 1930 to 1970. It's about leading liberals in the Roosevelt and subsequent administrations. They were building the New Deal state in the mid-20th century. They were also fighting World War II at the beginning and numerous other wars and small wars afterwards, which vastly increased the military and national security state. They had anxieties about big government. Anne wrote about them and tried to deal with the question of big government. So, Anne Kornhauser, tell us about their fears of the big state. Did those fears go to both the helping state, that meant a lot of the New Deal state, and the military and security agencies?
Yes, absolutely. First, let me just back up and say, most people probably know, but can't help to remind them that the New Deal in the 1930s is the time when we got the state we have today, basically, sometimes called the administrative state or the bureaucratic state, because of first a global economic crisis called the Great Depression, and then a global war, World War II, the government had to expand and to do so rapidly. Speaking of the domestic side first, the New Deal brought on board dozens of new agencies, boards, and commissions, some of them temporary, but most of them permanent, such as the Securities and Exchange Commission, the Social Security Administration, the TVA, the National Labor Relations Board, etc. So let me just first say that, of course, there was a lot of support for the New Deal state, especially in the beginning. It did things, after all, like regulate the banks, provide jobs and social services, including welfare, unemployment insurance, and Social Security. And people understandably warmed to these programs and services. And they particularly realized that they were necessary in a time of emergency, but also as a matter of general fairness and well-being. So what I'm saying is a regulatory service provider state requires bureaucracy. It requires a lot of administrators who write rules for and implement programs and policies. And people understood that. Now, today we hear words like bureaucratic and administrative and think of these things in purely negative terms. And in many ways, they can and should be criticized. But at the time of the New Deal, liberal and left supporters of the growing executive branch generally did not flinch. Now, there were, however, important liberal and left critics. We're used to thinking of critics of bureaucracy and the big government as conservatives, but in fact, they have spanned the political spectrum, certainly since this time, if not before. Now, the problems that liberals and social democrats who had escaped from mostly Germany and come here identified had to do with the effects of a large public bureaucracy on constitutional democracy. These were social scientists, lawyers, legal academics, others, and some of whom served in the Roosevelt administration. And they worried about, let's say, a lack of representation of various less powerful interests in the decision-making now, charged mostly to bureaucrats. They worried about open deliberation in that decision-making. And they also worried about the erosion of the rule of law. And what do I mean by that? Well, bureaucrats, as opposed to legislators, operate more according to informal and flexible guidelines and less on the basis of hard and fast rules that are transparent and public and that we can learn about more easily, and those are called laws. Compared to the lawmakers of Congress, bureaucrats or administrators have much more discretion in how they make decisions, and they are less accountable to the public. Their decisions are also less transparent, although one of the reforms that came out of the New Deal called the Administrative Procedures Act did require some published accounts of rulemaking and hearings. So liberals wanted more open processes, ones that avoided the powerful interests, the corporate interests, having more influence on the bureaucrats. And they also wanted public participation. Now, during the New Deal, of course, conservatives also complained about this rapidly growing centralized state. Both sides, I should say, everybody worried about the increasing use of emergency powers by the president. And Roosevelt was very free with using those powers, first to address economic crisis and then the war. Emergency powers can be invoked in a crisis, of course. Now, just to say one last thing about the conservatives, to compare them to liberal critiques, they were mostly concerned with what they're still mostly concerned with today, which is the intrusiveness of this new big government in the capitalist system. Specifically, they worried about the effects of government on competition and profit-making. And just to bring it up to the present, I noted that David Brooks the other day in the New York Times said that he was concerned about new signs that so-called progressives are wanting more government interference in capitalism because of inequality, because of the economic crisis of 2008. He wrote, capitalism sets up a system of discovery as different people compete and adapt in accordance with market signals. If you try to get technocratic planners organizing investment markets or internal business governance, you will wind up with perversities and rigidities that will make everything worse. Brooke describes the current battle over government regulation of capitalism as those who support competition, like him, versus those who believe, quote, you need strong government to defeat oligarchy.
Well, that sure is blind to the last few years of, let's say, the finance industry, which basically has escaped regulation by taking over the regulators. My sense is that they were playing fast and loose with even the rules that do exist, that we were much better served when the finance industry was before the deregulation than after it. Does Brooks and the other conservatives, do they recognize that capitalism also requires companies, especially ones whose profit margins are not as great as others, to get close to approach breaking all of the rules and, in fact, become criminal, which is what happened in the savings and loan industry and the derivative industry and all the rest of the stuff that they did? How would they deal with these questions?
I mean, well, that's a good question, and I can't entirely answer that, but I will say this. First of all, I think it's important to point out that the big act of deregulation, alas, occurred under the Clinton administration with the repeal of a New Deal legislation called the Glass-Steagall Act, which regulated how banks could invest our money, right? And therefore, how much they could win or lose. That clearly, as you suggested a minute ago, was a big factor in the problems of 2008. That is the absence of that, of those regulations. I think what some critics of more regulation of the financial industry would say is that criminal activity should certainly be punished, but that that is a small part of what generally is a wealth-providing, you know, crucial backbone of our economy. Of course, it should be regulated against criminal activity, and there should be some transparency, but capitalist institutions function best, they would say, with the least amount of interference by the government.
Well, that's sort of an empirical matter, I guess, that we can't get into. Surely they create an enormous amount of wealth, but there are real questions about who receives it and the extent to which they're going to fry the planet. Global they don't have a system that stops them from polluting. It seems to me there are so many reasons that they have to be regulated. Conservatives, it seems to me, will, although they have their ideology, which blinds them. It seems preposterous to take that position right now when we're facing these enormous threats to the global climate system and the ecosystems upon which we depend. And that's only one. I mean, also the inequality across the world.
Well, two things. One, I don't want to suggest that conservatives and or Republicans have never supported this kind of regulation. They have. They did in the 30s. They did in subsequent decades. But it is true they less often do than liberals and Democrats. But it's not a partisan issue, as you know, because liberals and Democrats are also very much funded in politics by the financial industry as well. So it's definitely not reducible to partisan politics. However, you're right that there is not a lot of clamoring for significant reform, both on internal governance in the banks, but also you're hinting at another problem. I don't know how much banks contribute to this, but global warming and the problem of carbon pollution.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Ann Kornhauser. She teaches history at City College in New York, and she just published a book, Debating the American State, Liberal Anxieties in the New Leviathan, 1930 to 1970. Ann Kornhauser, you discussed earlier, there really isn't, with the rise of enormous corporate power and wealth, the only thing that can restrain them is a big state with enforcement power and that doesn't become captured by the people they're supposed to regulate. In the long run, there are, of course, other possibilities. But tell us, what were the liberal visions through those years? There were a lot of people who were alarmed by the rise of the big state and unaccountable bureaucracies and bureaucratic creep and
right.
regulatory capture and all the things that happened. What were their proposals in trying to deal with those, with the bureaucratic troubles?
Well, let me just first say that, back on the corporations for a moment, I don't think the big state is the only answer, and I know that's not what you were saying, but just to clarify, one of the things being talked about now, both by people, say, from Occupy Wall Street and some politicians, is a more open process of corporate governance where shareholders and even the public might participate or at least see what decisions are being made and how they're being made. So I do think that citizens have a role to play here too. As far as reining in the government, which just grows, by the way, it just keeps growing, and that's to some degree inevitable, the solutions were not fast and furious in coming, partly because the period I looked at was so ridden by crisis, but certainly actually campaign finance reform is one thing that has come up over and over again, so that in theory, politicians are not so beholden to big interests, and they in turn influence the bureaucrats. But also, again, more open and transparent processes within bureaucratic government for people, regular citizens, to participate. And that includes, say, through hearings or, you know, where the public is invited, lots of publicity to what is being debated in terms of rules and regulations, whether it's for pollution or welfare or whatever. The problem is, and this debate did occur in the 60s and 70s, does the public care enough, or does the public want to be involved in the way that these liberals thought they should be? And that, I think, remains an open question. You mentioned at the beginning, and then I haven't talked about it yet, but that's the national security side of things and the war-making powers of the state, which have also grown exponentially, starting really with World War II. And I just wanted to say that issue there is also about executive and in many ways bureaucratic power, especially if you include the military in the bureaucracy, and that we're in an interesting position these days where we don't go to war exactly. We don't declare wars either at the beginning or at the end. We have a kind of endless, unspoken at times, armed conflict against groups in various countries that we call usually terrorists or sometimes Islamic extremists. And I think that that also is an area where the abuse of power can easily take place.
Ann Kornhauser, we're talking about popular participation and, in fact, the problem of enticing people or of inviting them and getting a response of people to actually be involved in decision-making and participating in the key decisions. I think people actually love to be participants and want to be consulted. The problem is, I think, the way the system is now, and it's increasingly, it seems to me, structured, most people don't get the experiences or the skills or the knowledge and recognize that walking into a room full of experts is a really daunting problem. It's hard to get parents now to go to the schools because they feel often that some parents do and many do, and the more wealth they have, the more they are ready to be active. But it seems to me we have a real basic problem of controlling either corporate power or bureaucratic creep and operating according to their interests and making decisions that are suboptimal. Part of the problem is that people are not accustomed to and don't get the experiences, starting very early, of making those kinds of decisions and getting the skills and knowledge to do it. In fact, that's one reason that it seems to me when we talk about a democracy in daily life, democracy in daily life is necessary to equip people and structure into life these opportunities to learn. And I think that's a bigger problem, in fact, than creating more rules and developing governmental structures of transparency. So many people are really excluded from the kind of that process and a life of, in fact, intervening that way and really being part of the way the world works. And that would take a real revolution, it seems to me, where that restructures most of our organizations quite radically. And you can comment on that.
This is a bit out of my area of expertise.
Well, you're a citizen.
But I will, exactly, and I will say this one thing. It's civic education, which sounds old and traditional, but really it doesn't have to be, because you can define it in any way you want. What makes a good citizen? What makes a knowledgeable citizen? I do think that all up and down our educational system, and that's not the only way, but it's one way, we have to think not just about training people for skills or esoteric knowledge, although I believe those are important too, but for being able to participate in the democracy, which is crucial. And it's something that is an old idea all the way back to the Romans. Not that they had a democracy, but they did have an awareness that citizens needed to be vigilant about their government in particular. Back then, they didn't have large corporations. And I think that one of the things I do as a college professor is to try to bring in current examples and also just think about how can I help these students understand how to think critically about all of the institutions, you know, that they live with. I acknowledge that not that many Americans get to go to college, so I'm already dealing with a select group, but there's no reason this can't be done earlier on in the educational process as well.
Okay, I'm ready to accept that as part of the picture. My sense is that and it's happening in families much more than it's happening in the workplace. My sense is that it has to be in daily life, where people on a daily basis are, and it's important to them to participate. Now, where families are structured in an egalitarian manner, where kids are actually sort of involved according to their capacities, they do develop more skills and the expectation that they're going to be listened to and that they have the capacity to actually be participants. Even more important, most of us work most of our life, I mean our waking life, a very high percentage of the time is involved in labor of one kind or another, not just paid labor to be sure, but also unpaid labor of keeping the society going and reproducing itself. And if work is top down and if people don't have a sense of on a daily basis being involved to some extent in shaping the way the work is done and in rotating work, and those, it's very hard to maintain a democracy. And because people don't get that experience and challenge that's necessary. In any event, that's my hypothesis.
Well, I think John Dewey would agree with you. And I certainly think it's hard to argue against people both feeling like and actually having more control over all aspects of their lives. And I also understand and agree that the workplace and the home are the two predominant sites for people's daily experiences. If you're talking about more workplace democracy, to a point, I think that is a good idea. On the other hand, not every institution can be run democratically, certainly not through and through. And that was a lesson I learned actually in graduate school when I was agitating for some changes in my own department. And my quite lefty professor said, you know, this is not a democracy. And he's right. And if we turn every institution into a kind of free-for-all, we're going to have trouble that way, too. So I don't...
There's no question about it, but it doesn't have to be a free-for-all. There's apprenticeships. And even, there are responses to that, but we don't have time for that. Maybe another time we can talk about the possibilities of democratization. I think they're much greater than we generally imagine. Although expertise and experience and background do make a difference in all sorts of places and should be respected. Ann Kornhauser, thanks so much for talking to us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so long.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. We all know that capitalism isn't good for us as individuals. Shopping till we drop, keeping up with the Joneses, experiencing need where there is no need. The debilitating effects of capitalism on the individual are well documented. Yet we are constantly bombarded with capitalist propaganda telling us that there is no other way. I'd like to share with you today an article entitled Refusing Capitalism by Colin Todhunter. Capitalism is based on addiction, Todhunter begins. It encourages people to crave for more and more wealth and more products. Ridiculously wealthy people want even more riches, resulting in war, exploitation, and the immiseration of working folk. In turn, ordinary people have been encouraged to take out ever greater debts in order to purchase an endless stream of goods of dubious worth. This addictive behavior is ultimately ruinous for the individual, humankind, and the environment, which becomes stripped bare in the process. Edward Bernays is regarded as the father of advertising, propaganda, and public relations. He knew how to manipulate the pleasure and pain centers of the brain and how to get the masses hooked on the products of capitalism. This type of manipulation has been developed and perfected over the past century or so, and we're all subjected to it each and every day. The American Academy of Pediatrics has reported that young people see 3,000 advertisements a day and are exposed to 40,000 different ones per year. It's not without good reason that the late academic Rick Roderick said that modern society will fall apart if it were not based on people's addictions, whether in the form of pharmaceutical drugs or consumer products. Capitalism does not want a well-informed, educated populace that is aware of its disenfranchisement, exploitation, and manipulation. It does not require disenchantment and revolutionary murmurs, but acquiescence and passivity from a population that is distracted by infotainment and the advertising industry and its products, and looks to its leaders to save it from their fears and confusions. A propagandist model is used to justify the prevailing neoliberal economic agenda. Think of the mantra, there is no alternative, which the media and politicians like to chime when people question the efficacy of capitalism. This mantra has been accepted by all the major political parties in places like the U.S. and U.K. Individualism and self-reliancy are endlessly promoted. Anyone suggesting collectivism and equality is painted as an unrealistic dreamer or a heretic. Indeed, it can be easy to look at the situation today and become excessively pessimistic and negative. Cynicism and apathy can take hold. This is the way the world is, and nothing can or should be done about it. And this is the very stance that is encouraged through the media and by the political system as a way of preventing people seeking out emancipatory alternatives. The state provision of welfare, education, and health services, and the role of public sector undermined by platitudes about individual responsibility and the market constituting the best method for supplying human needs. The same attitude prevails when it comes to protecting the environment. Nothing must be allowed to stop the raping of the land because this is positive. This is growth. The hollowed greed is good mantra persists. Much of this indoctrination all too often goes unnoticed. The most benign methods of propaganda can be the most effective. Take those 40,000 commercials the youngsters see each year. They are all underpinned by free market dogma, which serves to bind the individual to the commodity and portray social relations under capitalism as somehow natural, the outcome of human nature. And this becomes ingrained from an early age as common sense among many ordinary folk who sneer at those who challenge capitalism while embracing a system whose only aim is to stab them in their collective back and bleed them dry for the benefit of the few. The system promotes a mass mindset that is immune to the lies. Too many people now see through the lies of economic neoliberal hegemony and capitalism, however, and realize that the encouragement of cynicism and apathy and of trivializing or ridiculing dissent and dissenters is part and parcel of the propaganda. Herbert Marcuse once wrote about the great refusal as a strategy for not participating in the rituals and beliefs of advanced capitalism, challenging the notion that freedom is to be found in craving for and in celebrating the products and icons that chain people to an enslaving system, in the belief that this constitutes freedom and happiness is also part of that refusal. More people must come to understand that modern liberal democracy has nothing to do with empowering people and everything to do with enslaving them and making them blind to the chains that bind them. It is the powerful think tanks headed or funded by private corporations, along with government bodies populated with individuals from these companies, that drive policies. The challenge lies in developing communities that engender a sense of camaraderie stemming from collective self-help and face-to-face interaction. We must move away from falsely equating well-being or happiness with addiction to consumer goods. This shift involves rejecting the goods and services being forced upon us by large, powerful corporate interests, while placing more emphasis on self-sustaining local communities in which biodiverse organic agriculture and local food sovereignty is central, and where there is sustainable use of the environment. And this is as true for the rich countries as it is for the poorer ones. We must do this, because if we don't, we're in line for more of the same, an ever spiral of misery, war, subterfuge, and deceit. Colin Todhunter is an extensively published independent writer and former social policy researcher based in the UK and India. This article, Refusing Capitalism, can be found on the Counterpunch webpage.
Well, you know that it's going to be all right. Everything will always be alright when we go shopping. Well, you know that it's going to be alright when we go shopping. It's always like shopping's free begin. Everybody wins, so shut up.
This is the Omo Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and that was a song titled Shopping by the Bare Naked Ladies. Barry Schwartz is a well-known and highly regarded American psychologist. He is professor of social theory and social action at Swarthmore College. He has a new book coming out entitled Why We Work. Schwartz wrote an op-ed piece in yesterday's New York Times discussing this forthcoming work, which asked the provocative question, is it human nature to hate your job? Not so, Schwartz argues. We genuinely desire meaningful work. But today, psychologists Jan Hocken and Todd Sloan are going to discuss an earlier work by Schwartz entitled The Paradox of Choice, which asks the question, is too much choice psychologically harmful? The piece begins with a short introduction by Todd, followed by playing a short section of a talk by Schwartz, which lays out his genuine argument and concludes with Jan and Todd's critique.
So one of the most fascinating areas of psychology deals with the psychology of decision-making. Decisions are very complex moments that bring together our life histories, our current life situations, the local environment, and larger social and cultural processes all in one, sometimes agonizing expression. A sub-area within the psychology of decision-making looks at our economic choices. It asks, how do we make decisions about what we need, what to buy, how much to spend, which product is best, and so on. Its findings bear on how we think about free will, ideal political economic systems, and even the meaning of life, since some people these days say that we basically are what we buy. Barry Schwartz is one of the leading researchers in the area of psychology and economic behavior. His 2004 book, The Paradox of Choice, is seen as an important contribution. Schwartz brings in the emotional aspect of choice, which is usually neglected in the dominant rational actor model of human behavior that's employed in economic theory. In The Paradox of Choice, he focuses on the phenomena of disappointment and satisfaction in choice making, and argues that the wide range of product choices we have in affluent consumer society, which should make us the happiest beings on earth because we have such a good chance of getting exactly what we need or want, instead lead us to paralysis in decision making and end up decreasing satisfaction, which in turn lead to misery and depression. This is a serious matter because one of the purposes of advanced consumer society is to increase our sense of freedom in choosing lifestyles, careers, partners, hobbies, and our pleasures. And if this is not making us happier, what's the point of it? Also, since many of us like to think that a major task of life is to fashion ourselves through the choices we make, what does it mean if the options with which we are presented most obviously are those offered in advertisements and windows of shopping malls? We've selected a bit of Barry Schwartz's TED Talk on the paradox of choice for us to listen to. He describes his basic thesis here. Some of you might have heard it already since it has had 7,800,000 views.
You missed them. But I want to start with what I call the official dogma. The official dogma of what? The official dogma of all Western industrial societies. And the official dogma runs like this. If we are interested in maximizing the welfare of our citizens, the way to do that is to maximize individual freedom. The reason for this is both that freedom is in and of itself good, valuable, worthwhile, essential to being human, and because if people have freedom, then each of us can act on our own to do the things that will maximize our welfare, and no one has to decide on our behalf. The way to maximize freedom is to maximize choice. The more choice people have, the more freedom they have, and the more freedom they have, the more welfare they have. This, I think, is so deeply embedded in the water supply that it wouldn't occur to anyone to question it. And it's also deeply embedded in our lives. I'll give you some examples of what modern progress has made possible for us. This is my supermarket, not such a big one. I want to say just a word about salad dressing. 175 salad dressings in my supermarket. If you don't count the 10 extra virgin olive oils and 12 balsamic vinegars you could buy to make a very large number of your own salad dressings in the off chance that none of the 175 the store has on offer suits you. So this is what the supermarket is like. And then you go to the consumer electronics store to set up a stereo system, speakers, CD player, tape player, tuner, amplifier, and in this one single consumer electronics store, there are that many stereo systems. We can construct 6.5 million different stereo systems out of the components that are on offer in one store. You got to admit that's a lot of choice. In other domains, the world of communications. There was a time when I was a boy when you could get any kind of telephone service you wanted as long as it came from Ma Bell. You rented your phone, you didn't buy it. One consequence of that, by the way, is that the phone never broke. And those days are gone. We now have an almost unlimited variety of phones, especially in the world of cell phones. These are cell phones of the future. My favorite is the middle one, the MP3 player, nose hair trimmer, and creme brulee torch. And if by some chance you haven't seen that in your store yet, you can rest assured that one day soon you will. And what this does is it leads people to walk into their stores asking this question. And do you know what the answer to this question now is? The answer is no. It is not possible to buy a cell phone that doesn't do too much. So, in other aspects of life that are much more significant than buying things, the same explosion of choice is true. Healthcare. It is no longer the case in the United States that you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you what to do. Instead, you go to the doctor and the doctor tells you, well, we could do A or we could do B. A has these benefits and these risks. B has these benefits and these risks. What do you want to do? And you say, Doc, what should I do? And the doc says, A has these benefits and risks, and B has these benefits of risks. What do you want to do? And you say, if you were me, Doc, what would you do? And the doc says, but I'm not you. And the result is we call it patient autonomy, which makes it sound like a good thing. But what it really is a shifting of the burden and the responsibility for decision making from somebody who knows something, namely the doctor, to somebody who knows nothing and is almost certainly sick and thus not in the best shape to be making decisions, namely the patient.
So I'm curious, Jan, what do you think of this approach?
Oh, I can't decide what to focus on. I'm so overwhelmed with the choices and the points I want to argue against here that I'm virtually paralyzed. But let me try.
Go ahead, and we'll see if we're not too disappointed.
This point. Right. Okay. Well, Schwartz is part of a long tradition of critical inquiry. He identifies himself as a social action researcher. He's interested in real problems in the world and bridging the research traditions in psychology and critiques of how our society operates and its assumptions. I think when he talks about the official dogma that we all accept, there's a long tradition of not accepting what some of us would call the dominant ideology of capitalist society.
That is all about freedom of choice and choosing your own lifestyle and your all that.
Well, yeah, and that commodity culture really defines the realm of human freedom. And I think part of what's problematic is the general sweep of his claims and the overreach of his critique and not attending enough to the difference between the struggles for choice in around healthcare, where I think it's an advance that today doctors can't just tell you what to do based on often very limited information. There's more, I think, cultivated some degree of humility. Doctors have to pay attention to the good ones, to patients' own decision making, and he mocks that to say that is the same. And later in the same talk, he says you can even now have to choose your gender, choosing a life partner. To sweep all of these together, I think it does tremendous disservice to social movements that have struggled for meaningful choices, where their range of freedom has been pretty nil.
So you're saying that the specific contexts of a choice really determine what kinds of choice making we might make? Or isn't there some kind of general, it's good to make a decision this way, like look at what you value and what your options are and realistically, rationally come to the best selection? Or wouldn't that apply to all those different contexts? Or is there something different about, I mean, I'm not saying this just to joke, but I mean, in the process of decision making, is it really different for something like choosing a career versus choosing what you're going to do this afternoon?
Well, there's a long line of psychological research and decision making that has been criticized as not giving enough weight to the level of investment in the decision. I think even Schwartz would agree with that you know, people are brought into a laboratory and given, you know, 10 jams or 20 jam samples on the table, and they may not even eat jam, and then they're told, asked to pick which one's best. That most of the recent literature does not support Schwartz's claim that people just as a function of number of choices become paralyzed. Now, obsessives do, which I wouldn't want to get diagnostic here, but
I remember
Schwartz sounds a bit obsessive. Like, you know, there's some kind of something about the number of choices that is inherently overwhelming. It depends on many other factors.
And the opposite, and there are people who load their particular choice with a rush of emotion and good feeling and ignore the other rational options, right? It's on the opposite end of the obsessive scale.
Yes, what used to be called hysterics.
Right.
There's so much.
I remember one study that fascinated me. I'm not sure what the implications are of a researcher who put out 5 identical nylon stockings and had people then choose which one was the best and then make up reasons why. And he knew they were exactly the same. So people will give reasons that obviously are just totally fictional to be able to justify their choices after the fact. So,
and there is that critical line of inquiry. I think Schwartz is kind of part of a long tradition that looks at how we've been tricked around choice. And of course, any parent knows this. I used to try to get my son to go to sleep by seeing his eyes widen in anxious desperation as the lights were going out. I'd say, do you want the door open or would you like it closed? Open, okay. You know, good parents know how to give choices that really, where you have narrowed profoundly the range of choices, but that people like to feel they're choosing. And of course, marketers trick us all the time with that psychological logic. But then to just dismiss it entirely, I think, really does a disservice to the human struggle for meaningful choices.
You gave a good example there with the framing of the choice for putting a kid to bed, because it really comes down to, for me, an issue of what are the choices we're allowed to or that we're able to make within a certain social order? What kinds of things are what is the array of things that we get to participate in deciding about? And Schwartz, I think, conveys just this infinity of choices all over the place, all sort of the same at the individual level. And I don't hear a lot of talk about what might we decide collectively, what kinds of things should we be deciding about instead of deciding what kind of salad dressing we want, things like that.
Yeah, and there are other traditions that I think do not inform his project. And I know you've done work on Herbert Marcuse, whose his important book is part of the critical psychoanalytic tradition, his work in the 60s, particularly right. One-Dimensional Man. How do you think Marcuse would respond to Schwartz's
critique? I actually have a quote of his right here, Andy.
Good Marcuse choice.
Said in
Excellent choice.
50 years ago, he wrote, the range of choice open to the individual is not the decisive factor in determining the degree of human freedom, but what can be chosen and what is chosen by the individual. So I think he is really saying that there are areas of life, for example, or in social order, social forms, that we don't have chances to reflect on, partly because of the ideological constraints. For example, you know, people keep saying we have two political parties. We really have a lot more than that, right, in the United States. But they tend to be ignored because of the pressure to move toward the middle and choose.
And then there's that whole Tweedledee Tweedledum that they're not real differences.
Right, which they're not, which obviously can't get into that now. But I think so. The range of choices and areas we could be reflecting on and making decisions about is really so much more important than how this issue of like when we have 30 options within one irrelevant or trivial area, how do we make a decision?
Yeah, and Marx's theory of commodity fetishism, I think, is also really important in kind of in helping us understand how commodity culture presents a dazzling, seeming dazzling array of choices, that it's not only the number and the flooding of the market with pseudo choices, but that these how objects are produced. And this was part of his notion of commodity fetishism, was that the objects are extracted from the context of their production. So we don't know when we buy an object anything about the people who made it, unless there's a kind of a high-end craft market. But
And at the same time, the object itself has this kind of aura or a glow that partly produced by the advertising, but partly because of this disconnect, it just sits there on the shelf wanting to be bought by us, and we feel this, right?
Right, that it acquires a kind of magical aura of its own, and we become disconnected from our own desires in the process. And that was, of course, part of Marcuse's point about what would he say about the dogmas, as Schwartz describes it, the dogma of our society, how it's different in consumer culture versus maybe earlier times in capitalism.
Yeah, what he would really emphasize now is the degree to which the market has played a function in satisfying our needs and wants, or at least creating wants in us that are basically false needs, in order to satisfy some of our, what we used to call lower levels of gratification, or sensuous gratification, as opposed to sort of higher forms of meaning and satisfaction through connection with others. Or so, for example, there's a permissiveness that allows us to focus on sensual pleasure, on satisfying more base urges and so forth. I mean, the typical Freudian unconscious drives, aggressive sexual instincts, and these are sold to us, and in a way that ends up sort of pacifying us, because instead of having to find ways of meeting our social needs and satisfying ourselves in life through connection with other people and knowing ourselves and artistic creative projects, or even more less alienating forms of being in our bodies, we're just satiated, right?
And
that's called, it's called repressive desublimation, because we're not sublimating and finding deeper meanings anymore. We're just there sated, I guess.
And that it's different from the forms of repression that were more forbidding during more acquisitive phases or cumulative phases of capitalism.
Right, we had to work hard. You didn't have so much pleasure.
Work hard till you drop dead.
Right.
Yeah, and just a minimal amount to keep a worker going. And that consumer culture under advanced capitalism seems liberating and freeing. But he was interested in exposing those illusions. But part of also, I think, what's troubling about Schwartz's project is how he does, as one antidote, he talks about the good enough choice, being reconciling ourselves with less than perfect choices, as though it's kind of a stance one can take. It's kind of a self-help argument, be happy with less, decide you're going to be happy with less. And then also he argues for non-reversible choices, that this idea that every, and I think he's critiquing this sort of contractual approach to life, that commitments, relationships, everything's a contract, and I'll be here for you as long as you make me feel good, and then I'm out. And of course, I think most people don't really operate on that principle, but then to argue for non-reversible choice denies in such a profound way the importance of people having certain freedoms, and also I think is an example of how critics of capitalism can take a very conservative turn. Many places in the world have mobilized support in opposition to consumer culture and imposed very severe restrictions that fall, of course, most heavily on women.
Yeah. I think it's important to bring up the dimension that in itself, the availability of more product choices is not repressive, and there are ways that we can enhance our lives. And for example, if I'm an artist and I want to go out and buy some paints that work better or last longer or something, that's good, instead of just having some clay with tint in it or something that isn't going to last very long, or clothing for certain purposes, or there are lots of things that are, I think, enhance our freedom in meaningful ways. And so there's sort of we need to avoid a knee jerk, and especially if it leads to this kind of, okay, let's not have anything,
right, and asceticism, right. A kind of left or conservative asceticism. And also the difference between being able to choose a fancy stereo system and choosing between a handful of products in a supermarket that's basically a food desert for poor people. I mean, there's, at the very end, there's kind of a slapped on point. Well, there, in his TED talk, well, there is a problem in the world where people have too few choices. I'm talking about us affluent societies, as though everyone in the U.S., our burdens are too many consumer choices, whereas it's not just that poor or working class people have too few choices, but the choices available to them are often impoverished as well. And actually, wealthy people have often a very kind of exquisite set of choices that would be better if other people also were able to stay in a nice place or go to a nice holiday.
Right.
And often people have been told to accept far less than they should in terms of this whole, he's kind of a preacher of lowered expectations.
There's another angle on this, which is probably the main one I would have, which is that it focuses on the individual consumer and the individual just thinking by, thinking on their own, right? As opposed to a social being who is in dialogue with others, either if it's about an individual choice, but it seems to bypass the dimension of what we could be reflecting on together about what we want, and even the possibility of democratically shaping what kinds of products are developed by industry, for example, or, I mean, it's sort of an old socialist idea, I suppose, but the idea that our needs could be met more directly by a democratic input into science and technology development and so forth. So I really find myself bristling right away when I see this puzzling about individuals deciding in isolation about what trivial product to buy. It seems like, well, that's not our biggest issue.
Right. And the deeper social context of choice is kind of stripped away. And that's a problem we've talked about in our earlier shows that is common to psychological research, is the focus on too narrow a context, like how many objects are on the table and which one you pick, versus who's in the room, how that context is established, and who opposes constraints from the very outset.
And in, like, your clinical and counseling work, everybody knows how complex decisions are for people, really, as they live their lives, and how much agony and reflection is possible in relation to them, and how even when the choices are made, there's still doubt, anxiety, going back over and over again, thinking about some, for some people, and others who go merrily along. But still, these are quite complex psychological phenomena that deserve a fuller interpretive sort of approach.
So let's return as we continue with the choices activists make, whether to go to that demonstration, whether anything's going to come out of a strike. I mean, these are also existential choices that leftists have had to make historically. And we'll continue with our conversation about choice and its constraints and possibilities. It's Jan Hocken and Todd Sloan talking today about Barry Schwartz's work on the paradox of choice.
Say that choice is freedom. I'm so free, it drives me to the point.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view. That is, grassroots struggle from the ground up. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. We want to announce an evening of discussion and music with Joe Uline on October 10th at 6:30. At the AFL-CIO Union Hall, 3645 Southeast 32nd. Joe is the co-leader of the Labor Network for Sustainability with Jeremy Brecker, who we interviewed on this program last week. But now stay tuned at 10 for Air Cascadia, presenting headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Locus Focus is off today. Instead, we'll hear Radio Echo Shock with host Alex Smith. Today's guests are two scientists and a firefighter, Mark Cochran, Park Williams, and Lou Paulson. They'll talk about climate change, superfires, and the current batch of Western wildfires.
Table Community Radio is proud to present Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon, as part of the KABLE at the Clinton Monthly Film Series. Arresting Power documents the history of conflict between the Portland police and community members throughout the past 50 years and creates a space for understanding the impacts of police violence and imagining a world without police. Again, that's Arresting Power, Thursday, September 10th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.